Okay, welcome to episode 23 of the Never On Anything podcast. Podcast has been created to keep you occupied during the virus lockdown. Firstly, before we begin, thanks to Jeffrey MT. I've got our first ever iTunes review. Thank you, man. And it's from someone I don't know, actually, which just makes a change. It's not my mum or something, so that's quite good. My name is Tony Esmond, writer of the Monster Spotters Club and Atomic Hercules, events rep at Nobel Comics, and editor of The Horizon Cafe, coming soon, by Emiliana Maleri. It's coming out from Marcosia Comics on the 22nd of June. You can pre-order it now. Today we see the return of a comics fan and blogger who is here to lay the knowledge down again. Yes, it's our buddy Richard the Don Sheaf. Hey, Rich. How you doing, man?
All right, man. You okay?
Yeah, good. Yeah. Is it the lockdown depression? It's got us both, isn't it? Sort of slowly. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to read a lot of comics. I've stopped. When I used to commute to work, I'd read a lot of fiction, not a lot of comics. Now I'm not commuting to work anymore. I'm like, right, these long boxes, I've got to empty them. So I've stopped reading fiction for about 3 months. I haven't read anything. I'm just reading comics. So
it's the opportunity of our lives. outside of retirement in old age, when our eyesight will probably be gone and we'll probably be a little bit crazy from reading too many comics. This is the opportunity, isn't it, really? We need to grasp
this
it.
This is it. Yeah. It's my early retirement practice. Got to check it out. Go, I could read a lot of stuff. So, reading loads of different stuff. But it's, that to read part, it's going down, I've got to say. It's going down.
Good stuff. That's good to know. It was always a weight off my mind as well. It always sort of guilts me out looking at the to read pile. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It sort of plays on my mind. Okay. So, what would you like to tell the listeners what you have chosen for us to talk about today?
Today I'll be talking about. We'll be talking about Asterix.
Good. And we've got a particular volume, haven't we?
I've particularly chosen for those reading along at home. Asterix and the Big Fight.
Excellent.
Book 9 in the series.
Is it book 9, is it? Cool.
According to my copy here, it says book 9 on the front. So.
Brilliant. Okay, yeah. That's good stuff. I'm just going to read out the little intro. Before we get into it, there's always a little intro at the start of an Asterix book. Thought it might be a cool thing to read out. The year is 50 BC. Gaul is entirely occupied by the Romans. Well, not entirely. One small village of indomitable Gauls still holds out against the invaders, and life is not easy for the Roman legionnaires who garrison the fortified camps of Tortorum, Aquarium, Laudanum, and Compendium. I'm surprised they got Laudanum in there, aren't you?
Yeah, that's a great one. You slid that in.
And the nearby towns of cocaine, heroin, and cannabis. I was quite impressed with that. I thought, but that's, I think, and we will undoubtedly talk about that. Is the beauty of this book?
Yeah.
Is it's there's so much to read in it. So when did you first come across Asterix? Was it as a kid, or how did it happen?
Talking of gateway drugs. So for me, Asterix and Tintin were, I can still sort of picture myself, as a small kid, sitting in the library, in the book stacks where they had, it was a big sort of long shelf almost. I mean, it was a bookcase, but you could, if you're only small, you can sort of hunker down. And read these books, and you had to read them in the library, because actually in my library when I was growing up as a kid, they'd only let you take 3 home with you. So actually, if you only went to the library once a week, because that was as much as your mum could bear to take to the library, you had to read a few while you were there. So that you felt you got a bit of value for money out of it. It's completely different now. My kids can take 20 books at a time,
can they? All online and all that sort of drama, isn't it?
So they've got no idea. They sort of look at me funny when I say, in my day, you can take 3 books home. So I used to read Asterix and Tintin books there, all in a big row. And it was just, which ones am I going to take home this week? It was a real...
That's interesting. I'll quickly skip past something we'll talk about in a minute. But for me, there was me and some school friends, and some of us read Tintin and some of us read Asterix. Was it that way for you, or was it just all-encompassing?
But they were all filed together in this library, so I suppose I never thought of them as being different. It was always just, there wasn't a graphic novel section, for anybody who says there's not very many graphic novels in my library, I think you've got no idea, my friends.
Wasn't even invented back then.
They're all there, they're all together. They're basically the same thing, I guess I could see that, styles were a bit different, and that sort of Lean Claire style, you'd call it, for tinting with that, that clear line, and it's a bit different from a Durso drawing asterisk. But to me, it was the same stuff in the same heap. They're clearly not English, and I love them. So so 1, 2, 3. There we go. Thank you very much.
Yeah, they were a common thing at libraries, weren't they? I don't know why. Just there must have been some canny salesman at Dargard or whoever was selling it, who got them into the libraries.
I mean, they've sold a lot of them. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you can believe what you like about Wikipedia, but it claims that Tintin sales in the early 2000s were 200 million volumes. 200 million. My God. And that is about half what Asterix has sold. That was knocking on. Oh, my God. 370 million copies by 2017.
I saw that one of them. 10%. I think it's Asterix and the Normans. It sold 1.4 million copies in 2 days.
I mean, no matter what you think about Watchmen, and that is the most influential, it's on the New York Times greatest books you'll ever read in your entire life. It hasn't sold 370 million copies,
I say. Yeah, exactly. Now, just quickly getting back to where we first discovered it, it's muddy. Those days are muddy. There's been a lot of narcotics under the bridge since then, Rich. But I'm going to say that I think I saw the cartoon first. I think...
Oh, really? I remember going to see one of the Asterix cartoon movies for Christmas once at a cinema that we would never go to, a long way away. And my parents obviously thinking, this is a very clever idea. And me thinking, but hang on, I want loot. I want stuff that I can go and talk about and show off in the playground.
I'm not middle really... class. I don't go to your fancy art house cinemas showing Asterix. Yeah. Okay.
So I think I probably came to the books first and then, saw at least one movie. But, I mean, they've made quite a lot of movies.
They have.
I mean, I think it's 9 movies, a theme park.
Yes, a theme park. I was watching that documentary.
A theme park.
And 4 live action. One of which has got, I think, 1 or 2 of them has got Gerard Depardieu playing Obelix in them.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he's spent a lifetime preparing for that.
He hasn't. I quite like that dude. But you're right. He's the shape of Obelix, isn't he? Yeah, he's even got the schnoz for it. Yeah,
he definitely got the schnoz. Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not here to knock Dave Gibbons and his work on Watchmen, but oh my God, 370 million copies. The first ever French satellite they launched was called Asterix. There's a theme park. I mean, Dave,
that's something, isn't it? That really is. Yeah.
Something.
Yeah, I think I saw it. I've got a feeling I saw a cartoon, and then I've got a feeling I was at boarding school I think I was 9 when I first went to boarding school, and I think we all sort of used to have to go into town with one of the brothers, one of the monks, and I would buy an Asterix, and my mate would buy a Tintin, and he was always saying to me, I think I prefer Tintin. He was always a bit of a snob. I think I prefer Tintin to Asterix, which just caused me to beat him up a lot in the playground. But do you know what I mean? In Asterix style.
That's interesting because, thinking about Tintin, Tintin first appeared in the Eagle magazine. That was the first time it was translated into English. It wasn't in a single standalone volume.
Yeah.
And what we'll look at today, these are the first appearances of these characters, before they get into the volumes that I would have come across in the library.
Yeah.
So Tintin appears... in Eagle in the 1951, it's the King Ottica's scepter story. Just runs across the sort of the bottom of the middle pages. So it's in colour, but obviously they've got to hack it about a bit to get it to squeeze in. But obviously it's in that in the world's most middle class magazine, Eagle. whereas Asterix isn't in Eagle. Asterix is in some slightly more working class comics, as we'll see.
That's interesting because Tintin. People think of Tintin and they think of the volumes, don't they? But Tintin was actually a magazine as well that featured other stories, I think, didn't it, as well?
Yeah.
And I know Uderzo, or not, maybe it wasn't Uderzo, Goscinny actually wrote some stories for Tintin magazine as well as his original stuff. Yeah. Yeah, we're jumping about a bit here. So should we talk a little bit about the history of Asterix before we get into the story? So it appeared in, as I understand it, Goscinny and, René Goscinny and Albert Uderzo met in 1951 and immediately hit it off, allegedly.
Yeah.
They had a relationship where they would discuss, I'm sure over a lot of bottles of red wine, would discuss the story. And then Goscinny, being the writer, would go away and write it, and he'd hand it to Alberto Dozu, who would then draw it. And that was kind of the relationship they had for many years, from all the way up to 1977, when René Goscinny sadly died at quite a young age, actually, younger than me, actually. He died of a heart attack at 51, and quite early. And from then on, Alberto Dozu carried on kind of on his own for a time. And then it was, as I understand it, the book was sold, because it was originally in... Is it, you know the pronunciation better than me here, Rich? Is it Pilot? Is that the?
Oh yeah, Pilote, isn't it? It's yeah, sort of the magazine. Yeah,
Pilot. Yeah. So which was a sort of long-standing book, like an anthology, I suppose, like a Beano or a Dandy or something like that, or a, you know, even a 2000 AD was that sort of thing. And he appeared in that, and jumping out of them were the albums. So I don't know if you read this, but for The Big Fight, there was actually a prelude for The Big Fight. Did you read that bit of it?
Oh, really? No.
Yeah. So to sort of whet the appetite for the French public to buy the next volume of Asterix, Vital Statistics has a sort of one-page, two-page press conference as part of Pilote, to announce that his book would be, the next one would be The Big Fight, which is interesting because Vital Statistics plays quite a big part in this, isn't he? He's kind of the Rocky character in this, isn't he? He's almost the Apollo Creed, I suppose, isn't he? Because your money's on him in the fight that happens. And he's the one who's sort of declaring at this press conference. Oh, I'd love to see that. It's not in the volume I've got. Is it in your one?
It's not in the one I've got. I'm just thinking, I've got, in my study upstairs, I've got a sort of odds and ends sort of volume,
which makes sense.
Sort of thing that it might have been in, because it's got sort of limited edition sort of stories or you know, things that, like you say, didn't make it into this completed into a whole volume. So yeah, I have to go in there and check that out. But yeah, it's an interesting one that they do, and like you say, that Adurzo and Goscinny, this wasn't the only thing they wrote together, but it's the most famous thing they wrote together.
Yeah, I mean, we'll drill down a bit into each of them later as we go on, but it's a lovely relationship they have, and it is, for those that haven't read Asterix, it's everything's a pun. They love a pun, don't they?
It's, you know, I mean, it's not quite every panel, but it's really close to every panel,
isn't it?
You know, yeah, there is a joke in every panel. You know, they are, you know, the translators who are Anthea Bell and Derek Hockridge, who translated all of these and translated a lot of other things. And actually, you know, we're actually translators who, as I understand it, translated a lot of fiction, because, you know, that was normally what they did. This was, just another piece of fiction. But, and we know them from their work on these volumes, but there were incarnations before this, which are translated very differently.
Oh, really? Okay.
But there are, but in these, I mean, they're just, you know, the language and the, you know, the corny jokes that they're making, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes you get like four or five characters in a panel, you know, four or five of these legionaries, Romans, in a panel, and they're all complaining about something, and they all make a joke based on a bit of wordplay.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just boom, 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 you know, five gags in a panel, move on, next panel, there's more gags. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just... Yeah. It's relentless.
And I think the thing is as well is every even the names are a pun. So Asterix, when you think about it, think about what the actual word Asterix is. Yeah. You know, it's that thing you put next to a footnote, isn't it? It's like that. That's what it is. Obelix is a play on words, because not only is it a lump of stone, I suppose, a stone obelisk, is something he also, he kind of carries around a thing a bit like that. Is it a menhir or mayhir? Or I can't remember the...
I could never, I still never really worked out what how to pronounce it.
But, or the purpose of it,
metaphorically somehow.
Dogmatics is the dog, you know, like we've said, Vital Statistics is the sort of chief of the clan of Gauls. And my favourite name of them all is Getafix.
Easy.
But this is the 50s, you know, this is when they were writing it, and Getafix is a main player in the book. He's probably sort of third or fourth character, isn't he, really? And he's the sort of slightly hippie wizardy character who makes a special broth that he gives to he gives to the whole village, doesn't he, apart from Obelisk, who fell into it as a kid. And Yeah, and it gives them sort of super strength and on occasion super speed as well. So when you realise that his name is Getter Fix, you know, he's a sort of hippie drug dealer, isn't he? Basically, is what he is.
I mean, I suppose we've got to think about when these were translated by these people, by Andrew Bell and Derek Hockridge, because they're translating these in 1971.
Ah, okay. Right, that makes sense.
So in the earlier comic incarnations, some of the characters have different names.
Yeah.
But actually, that means that by the time you get to 1971, everybody should be pretty clear about what Get a Fix means. You know, it's even at that point to go, hang on, I think I know what you're talking about here.
Yeah.
Rather than in the 50s where you might be able to brush it off and say, oh, well, that's just a happy hippie coincidence. But it's like 1971, no.
Yeah, I think we all know by then. I think the Stones had rubbed it in our faces enough by that point, didn't they? Yeah. Yeah. So it starts off as a lot of these Asterix books start off with them going hunting for boar. They're always hunting for boar, aren't they? It's a sort of common trait of theirs. And they sort of, they arrive back in the town, don't they, with these boars?
We're sort of slung over their shoulders, casual. You know, as a kid, I was like, wow, just the idea of eating wild boar. I was like, wow, that's amazing. I so wanted to eat wild boar. And, you know, we used to go on holiday to Spain when I was a kid, and there wasn't a lot of wild boar on the menu.
Yeah, we're seeing it now, don't we?
Costa del Sol.
We've seen it a bit with the sort of the reclamation of nature of some towns in, you know, France, haven't we? The boars are sort of running wild at the moment.
Well, it turns out now I sort of know a bit more about them. They rewilded a bit the Forest of Dean, which is near where my wife's family come from.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, you sort of, you realise that actually, you know, they are big brutes and you wouldn't really want to come across them, you know, on a dark night, because, you know, they could... They could do a bit of damage.
Yeah, the big old beast. Nothing to Asterix and Obelix. Though,
no.
I think Asterix was kind of vaguely based on an actual warrior, a Gaul warrior who, didn't he surrender to Julius Caesar? There's a similar sort of mustachio, you know, romantic drawing of someone, and I think they sort of say that they vaguely based him on that. Next thing that made me laugh, the Village of Linoleum.
That's the quality of gag you're going to get all the way through here. You know, it's not high class, it's not highfalutin, it's not set up in panel one, finish off in panel 15. You know, boom, there we go, linoleum. You've all after that, haven't you?
Yeah.
And the answer is, yeah, we have all after that, actually. Yeah,
it's a favourite dad joke of mine is, but when people ask me if I'm musical, I say I play on the linoleum. That's another, you know, that's the level of, which is why I think I've gotten so well with it. So we get they set up quite early the situation with the Gauls, the situation with the Romans, and the situation with this other sort of competing town called Linoleum. What's his name? Is it Cassius Ceramix? Is that his name?
Cassius, Ceramics, isn't it?
Ceramics, like, of course it is, yeah.
Ceramics, to be like clay, to be like Cassius Clay.
Of course it is. Ah, how thick am I? Yeah, yeah. So we get that, and he's a sort of pet Gaul. He loves the Romans,
and they
will set him up to fight Vital Statistics from Asterix's village at some point in this. We get quite a lot of joking with the Romans. Throughout this whole series, I don't know why they keep bothering them, but all they do is get a bit of a kick in from Asterix and Obelix, don't they? Virtually constantly.
There is a lot of that. I mean, it's just, you know, you look at a panel where they all get dressed up like trees, don't they, to go into the woods because they're going to go and spy on them. So you've got one panel and like the lead Roman says, try to look as botanical as possible. And then after that, it's just all that, there's half a dozen of them and they're all going to make a joke about trees. You know, the wordplay is, next one is the big sap. We're too big to play cops and robbers. I mean, that's that's two gags from one character. There's five other people that have been talking this panel yet. If you ask me, we're all suckers. I'm trembling like a leaf.
Yeah,
the woods. Yeah. stop! I can't keep up.
Yeah, if you had a friend who talked like that, he wouldn't be your friend anymore, would he? Do you know what I mean? It's like that. If I was my son would disown me.
A bit like meeting Robin Williams somehow. It's just, you know, just that verbal diarrhea of gags. You know, like they have to make gags all the time. They can't. you know, almost unwell.
So, somewhere between Robin Williams and Jimmy Tarbuck, I'm going to say.
Yeah.
And they're sort of in the woods. They're all dressed up as trees, very badly. And Getafix is sort of wandering around whistling, picking herbs. Let's say herbs.
Just say herbs.
And he sees a foot from sticking out from one of the trees, which confuses him. And Obelix appears carrying a menhir. Let's call it menhir.
Yeah.
Which he seems to spend the whole issue throwing it at people, doesn't he? That seems to be a theme.
It's a very unguided missile, but
eventually Getafix kind of loses his mind, doesn't he? He gets squashed by the men here, and he's tripping balls, I believe is the phrase that the kids use.
It doesn't work out well coming into contact with that men here for him, does he?
He's
lost his mind. So it's very, of all the books, you know, if you haven't read the books, I guess they sort of split into two categories. One where they go somewhere,
to
a country, and have an adventure, and there's a bit of laughing or racism, as my wife described it earlier when I said I was coming on here to talk about it. Isn't that racist? I was like, well, they're just going to laugh at the English. Well, don't spoil it for me.
Yeah, it's different times. But I think that's what we're wedged between, aren't we? Because we're wedged. This story comes after the one where they go and meet Cleopatra, which is quite a well-known film as well, I think, a cartoon film. And the next one is the one that we all used to love in England, which is where they go and fight the Britons, don't they?
And
don't the Britons who are fighting the Romans go say things like, oh, it's Saturday, so we don't fight on a Saturday?
Look, you're right. They don't fight on Saturdays. They don't fight after 5 o'clock. Rains a lot,
and they keep having tea breaks. Foggy.
Yeah, they have to stop battles for tea breaks. Yeah, it's driving the Romans mad. And it's only when Caesar comes over and decides that he's only going to fight after 5 o'clock and at weekends that they actually conquer Britain. Because before that, they couldn't conquer Britain. So they were playing fair. So there's a whole bunch of stories where they go somewhere. You know, they go to different countries.
Yeah,
somebody comes to the village, like a cousin or a friend or something. And then there's this other bunch of stories which are set in and around the village, and the sort of the problem is then often more amongst the Gauls themselves rather than they're fighting the Romans or the French, the Germans. It's a problem amongst themselves. And sometimes, as a kid, I remember those are the ones, you know, I think I like the more adventurous ones where they went somewhere different rather than the ones where they're sort of squabbling amongst themselves, because you think, oh, but I love all these guys. Why are they all fighting? Why are they all falling out? Why is unhygienic, you know, having a fight with somebody?
And also, it seemed to me a bit like those TV shows we had in the 80s where, you know, the Fall Guy in one episode a season would manage to go to New York or something, you know, but the rest were penny pinching, so he'd have to stay wherever it was he stayed, you know. And it's a bit like that. It's almost like, right, we don't want to design anything more. We don't want to go around designing pyramids or, you know.
Yes.
So we're going to just stick to the village for this one. That'll give Uderzo a bit of a break around drawing it. He doesn't have to design anything, you know, huge buildings and monoliths and, you know, sphinxes and stuff like that. So we're just going to be in the village.
Yeah. This is going off the point. It's not going off the point, but it's going off the topic for now. Did you go to that exhibition at the Jewish Museum?
I didn't.
You didn't?
No, I didn't end up going. I remember you telling me about it, and I didn't get to it. Was it good?
Yeah. Oh, it was fantastic. And they had that was an exhibition all about Uderzo, who's the artist. It was about Uderzo. And they had a lot of his stuff down, including some of the panels and, you know, some of his original art. And like I say, that the design, you know, there was one, and it was like a city, or, you know, not a city because they didn't have cities, but, you know, it's really big fortified town in a lake. And oh my God, you know, it was just, you know, so fantastically drawn. It was so beautifully done. You think, oh my God, you've spent days drawing that. You know, it's so fantastic. So yeah, I, as much as I didn't like them fighting amongst themselves, like I say, I'm sure there's a bit of, oh right, this is just trees. And Romans, that's fine.
You've got in this really is you've got the Roman fort, which I'm sure appears in a few, but and you've got the boxing ring. That's kind of, and the psychiatrist who we'll get to in a minute, who's class. That's my favourite bit. The one that I when I was reading this, you did come to mind because there's a lot of panels on a page compared to American comics, aren't there, in this?
Yeah, There's a lot here, you know, in terms of bang for your buck. I mean, there's eight or ten
a page
panels, you know, on a page, and as we've discussed, several jokes per panel anyway. So you know, and you know, sometimes they're visual jokes rather than actual puns. But you know, there's a lot to look up and look at, you know, in each of them. So
And it reminds me, in that way, it reminds me a bit of old school British comics, you know.
When
you used to get much more panels on a page. It's different for those thinking of 2008. It's not even like that. It's pre that. You know, it's like we were talking about earlier, Lion and stuff like that. There's that sort of thing had, because sometimes these stories were only two pages in British comics, weren't they? So they had to fit a lot in those two pages.
Yeah, because you've got to resolve, again, unlike American comics, where you've got a whole, you know, you've got 22 pages, so you can pace yourself out quite a lot. With British comics, before 2000 AD, you only had two pages.
Yeah.
So you had to resolve last week's cliffhanger, move the story on a bit, and set up another cliffhanger. So that, you know, the pacing of them tends to be quite breathless compared to an American comic, where actually, you haven't got that, you know, you've got 22 pages, so you can really spread it out of what you want to do. You can move the plot along slowly if you want, and that's fine. Whereas with British comics, you're no, there's no time for slow. You've got, you know, you have to set up, you know, a problem a week to be solved, and you have to solve it every week for 52 weeks. Boom, boom, boom. You gotta get through it. So
yeah, and that makes this quite a dense read. Actually, it's not a quick read, is it? It takes you a while to get through it.
No.
Yeah, I found that when I read it the other day. Yeah, and I thought, oh, that's I'm only on page 12 or something. You know, I'd have read two American comics in that time probably. Yeah,
we have to stop because you keep laughing.
That's it. Yeah, my sides are splitting. No, I know what you mean. Yeah. Should we talk a little bit about Uderzo? So he was born in 1927. He died earlier this year, sadly, at the age of 93. So he did well. He was the son of an Italian immigrant. In 83, he got the Legion of Honour. In 99, he got the Grand Prix de la Ville Angoulême. And his 2005 was inducted into the Eisner Hall of Fame. Couple of facts I read. I read this one on two sites, whether that took it from... one was Wikipedia, so I'm not sure if that's true. He was born with six fingers on each hand. Did you read that?
Oh, no, I didn't see that one.
That is... read on two websites, so you know, not confirmed. I've never seen his hands, so I don't know. And another one I read was that he was born colorblind. It was interesting. As a kid, he wanted to grow up to be a clown, which kind of makes sense. And he fell in love with Mickey Mouse and Disney comics as a kid, which is interesting. After Goscinny's death in 77, Uderzo took over for the writing as well, which is very wise. I think it was fairly seamless. He retired, but it was handed over, I think. Another company bought it and he gave up dealing with it. And in 2015 following the Charlie Hebdo attack, Uderzo came out of retirement and drew asterisks in honor of the victims of that attack, which is pretty cool. So he would have been 97 at that point, 98 at that point, which is pretty impressive. And a great talent. He didn't do a huge amount of other things, did he? I suppose this is going to take up most of your time when you're drawing this. Are you aware of any other works? Have you read any of his other stuff? Or
I've read so this whole sort of series. There's another series that he drew. So that Goscinny wrote and Uderzo drew.
Right.
Which is called Umpapa. Mm. Have you come across that?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, so again, very similar setup, you know, in terms of the... I think there's only, in English, there's only, I think, about four or five volumes of it translated.
Okay.
And that's set in colonial North America. And the sort of, in that instance, the sort of, the Obelix character is Umpapa, who's the sort of the Native American who lives there. And the Asterix character is like this, you know, slightly posh, idiot Brit. Who's trying to invade. But they end up, they sort of fall in together.
I wonder whether there's a little bit of the morals of the modern day for that not to be translated. I remember wandering around Angoulême and Sam and I wincing a tiny bit at a couple of things. I think the mores of the French are slightly different to the mores of the English and the Americans, I suppose. Off the top of my head, I can't remember the name of the French comic that's all about the little Native American kid, and I can't for the life of me remember it. But I was saying to Sam, you know, has anyone translated that from No Brown? He was saying, well, no, I don't know. I don't know whether anyone would take the chance, because there would be a bit of a, you know, a flare back from people saying, well, this is, let's face it, it's a little bit racist, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. I mean, that Oompa Pa series, I mean, that's written, I think that appeared in the 50s originally.
Right, yeah.
And I guess...
So that, that predates Asterix, I think, doesn't it? Is that right?
I think Oompa Pa comes first. So I guess it probably got translated in the 70s at the same time as they're doing all these other volumes, when they realised that, wow, these other volumes, you know, are probably, you know, selling a lot. And therefore they started republishing, you know, these at the same time to sort of get the same, you know, like, if you like that, you'll like this.
Okay.
But,
yeah.
You know, as a sort of a set of books that, you know, they're much harder to track down these days. So I guess they didn't really work out, as a story, you know, as a series. I think, like I said, I think there's only four of them that are published, but there's Oompa Pa. But I mean, Goscinny, actually, it was Goscinny, the writer who was the subject of that Jewish museum exhibition. It just happened to feature some of Adurzo's art. And that was, itself was a scaled-down version of an enormous exhibition they'd had in Paris at the sort of the Foundation Goscinny. You know, in the way that, you know, oh my god, that, you know, that would be amazing to go to, of all the stuff that he'd written over all the years. Because what I didn't realize until I went to that exhibition about Goscinny, he's sort of early life, so he was born in Paris, but then he moved, he went to North America, he went to New York.
And Argentina as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he lived in Argentina. So he lived. So he's in New York. He's in Argentina back in front. You know, so there's a bit of there's a bit of to and froing, but he sort of ends up just before 1950 in New York. And it was, you know, in this exhibition, you know, it points out that, you know, he was in quite a sort of impoverished sort of state. But in the end, you know, he ends up working in a small studio, and he becomes friends with Will Elder, Jack Davis, and Harvey Kurtzman.
Okay.
It's like, oh my god, it's like, they're like the elders of Mad Magazine. And so when I read that, I was suddenly like, it's sort of light bulb went. I could feel this light bulb turning on my head and going, "See, you, these people who would go on to write Mad Magazine, they were your friends.
Yeah.
And you took, you know, and you were all thinking the same way. You were all wanting to write the same way, all do your same things. They wrote Mad Magazine with it. You came back and you've written Asterix with it."
Yeah, that's true.
I can now see, you know, you all started at the same point with it. You all want to do something kind of crazy. They've gone off and done their crazy in America. You've come back to France.
And I think of all the sort of mad artists, I could see Sergio Aragonés drawing this. You know, there's definitely a straight line between the two of them. I would love to see that. But
Yeah, for sure.
That's interesting. Because people forget that whilst he is, for us, for me anyway, most famous for doing Asterix, Goscinny also wrote Lucky Luke, didn't he, for 20 years?
Yeah. I mean, Goscinny, I mean, yeah, you're right, it's an incredible amount of stuff. And, you know, and Lucky Luke, again, for people who haven't seen, I mean, I guess that is kept in print by Cine Books, they're up to about book 60 or something, aren't they?
It's
an incredible number, and, you know, maybe not all by Goscinny, but maybe they all are by Goscinny, you know, because they're, you know, an incredible series.
Yeah.
That I've written over a very long time. I've read a few of those, but not all.
Yeah, and they were cartoons, and they were. I think there's a live action movie, isn't there? I think a Lucky Luke live action movie. And
that was
a hell of a thing to be involved in. Two big, well, more than that, really, because he was also the he became the editor in chief at Pilot, didn't he, as well?
Yeah, incredible to sort of, you know, people trying to catch lightning in a jar once and come up with, you know, with one great idea. And I think it's incredible sort of what he contributes to and writes.
The other one you might know about, the other one that I read is Isn't a Good. Is that the other story he wrote?
Isn't a Good. So that's set in the Middle East in sort of the time, you know, when they had a caliph and viziers and so you know, whenever that is, I don't know, let's say about 1000 BC, or I don't know when it is, you know. In those days, that, again, there's a few of them that have been, there's maybe about, well, I don't know, 8 or 10 volumes of those. I've got
okay, all right, yeah.
And there was even an Isn't a Good comic three issues only.
Right, okay.
From the 90s. I got the first two issues. Oh, I can't find the third copy for love nor money.
That's
on my list. I'd like that. So
yeah, because it was a spin-off, isn't it? Good, wasn't it? Wasn't it a spin-off? He was a popular character in another story. I've got a feeling. Is that right? Okay. Yeah, I think he'd appeared in a couple of things, maybe in Pilot or Tintin or something like that. And then, and he did that with
Artists. He's up to no good. And again, it's translated by Anthony Bell, Derek Hotridge. So, you know, it's the same setup and the same sorts of gags. And, you know, and he's scheming because all he wants to do, I think he's sort of quite a sort of fat, indolent visit. Leader, isn't it? And he's always trying to plotting and scheming.
Right.
To get rid of him, and he's then going to become, you know, he's going to become the caliph instead of the caliph. I think that's his sort of phrase. So he's always trying to get rid of him. All these plans, they never work out. They always go wrong. those volumes, thinking about it, they're the same length as like an Asterix book.
Right.
So
that traditional album size.
48 pages. Yeah. But I don't think they always have 48 page stories. They often have 4 12-page stories.
Oh, okay, right.
So they're a bit shorter, so they're not these sort of big, long epics. It's more, this is my idea of the week to get rid of the guy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it unravels quite quickly. There we go, 12 pages, thank you very much. Right, I've got another idea. So, it's a slightly different setup. But, you know, fantastic for serialising it into albums. You know,
yeah, the way that definitely.
Like to do that sort of stuff, you know. It's just, there we go, four stories, you know, 4 editions of Pilote or Tintin, wherever it appeared.
Yeah.
There we go, thank you very much.
And he did that with Jean Tabaret, who was the artist on that, apparently. A couple of other stories he did. He did Signor Spaghetti. That sounds a little bit, I'm going to say sounds a little bit racist. And Prudence Petit Par. And that was in Tintin magazine, neither of which I've ever seen. Have you seen either of them?
No, I haven't seen that. No, I will at some point come up with an even better name for a comic strip. that was reprinted in a British title, so we won't finish. But I will mention that before the end.
Oh,
so.
good stuff. Looking forward to that. Yeah, good. Yeah. He was inducted into the Eisner Hall of Fame in 2005. I suspect that they did. That it was at the same time they were both inducted. And like I say, he died in 1977 of a heart attack, which was a real shame. Good. Okay, so that's the two of them. Incidentally, when Goscinny was editor-in-chief at Pilote, he hired Uderzo as his artistic director because they were buddies, which I kind of think is good.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. So they carried on with that. Let's have a look. There's a couple of other points I thought we could chat about. Yeah, so one of my favourite moments in this is they decide to take Getafix to... a psychiatrist because he's lost his mind. They need him to make the potion for the village so they can stand up against the Romans, and Vital Statistics can win this fight with the challenging local town's chief. So they go to the they go to a psychiatrist who is called Psychoanalytics. The one of the problems with Getafix is he decides he thinks it's hilarious to point at Obelix and fat shame him. So whole pages of this are fat.
It's all about fat shaming, this book. If you're not into fat shaming, this is not for you. But if you think it's funny, then you'll be right at home.
Yeah, and it's such a setup comedy moment, isn't it? They get to Psychoanalytics Druid, and he's got a secretary who's sort of quite a sexy blonde, you know. Big earrings sitting there, and they asked to see him, and she asked, even though these are the Gauls in 50 years BC, she asked him if they've got an appointment. the best thing about it is, you're right, then the gags come thick and fast again, and because you basically go past all of his different patients who are outside waiting to go in. There's a barbarian who's he's a shy barbarian, so he's all embarrassed, not in the way am I. You know, in his little barbarian script, there's a bloke who's holding his shield over his head and says, "The sky may fall in on me." And there's a man who thinks he's a wild boar, and then they do a Napoleon gag.
They do, yeah. Napoleon type gag.
There's a bloke with a sort of his hat turned sideways, like we used to do with Napoleon, didn't we? Yeah. And with his hand in his sort of in his chest of his shirt, and no one knows who this one thinks he is, but it's clearly Napoleon. You know, it's like. Yeah, those Napoleon jokes. They were such winners back in 71. Yeah.
And then in the next panel, you find out what this lovely blonde receptionist is called, and she's called Miss Bicarbonate of Soda.
They were stretching with that one. Come on. Yeah. That's like one of them looked up at the shelf, isn't it? That one's got to be. Yeah. So they get in to see him, and he's pretty classy. He's quite interesting, isn't he? He tries to get Obelix to lie down. He's confused about who he's meant to be seeing. And then he sort of convinces him that he's fat as well. So we get Obelix walking all the way back to the village with the two of them crying and saying, I'm too fat. Which is pretty fat-shamingly hilarious. Any favourite bits of yours, dude, as we go along? Yeah. Anything you wanted to talk about?
I mean, normally, you know, I like the fact, like I say, of how much Getafix has lost his mind.
Yeah.
He spends, normally, he can be a slight, not inconsequential, but, you know, he's there at the start when the setup. He gives Asterix a little bottle of magic potion and says, right, here we go. This will solve whatever problem you need solving.
Yeah.
And off they go. And then you see him at the end. There we go. Wasn't he clever making that potion? But in this, it's all about him.
Yeah.
Because he's been bashed on the head. He's lost his mind. And instead, he spends the whole book rolling around, you know, laughing because A, he thinks Obelix is fat and fat shaming him to his enormous delight. And then, he then obviously meets this other psychoanalytics character. And without spoiling anything, it doesn't really work out very well for psychoanalytics when he gets to the village. And psychoanalytics then spend the rest of the book laughing at each other, trying to recreate the magic potion and turn each other all sorts of funny colours.
That is a classic part of it, and that is clearly, I'm going to guess that Goscinny and Adezo had discovered the joys of purely illegal, don't buy it at home, kids, cannabis at that point. Because they are sort of pointing at each other and everything is funny, isn't it? Everything they see in the whole world is funny. there's a bit that I really liked as well. So he keeps trying to make the potion, but he can't remember as well, get a fix, isn't he?
He's stuck on.
And they test it, or this Roman soldier tests it on himself. And the Roman centurion he goes green, then he goes purple. But then, for a sight gag, he then gets purple spots, then he gets green hoops, then he gets a sort of a red and yellow checkerboard on his face and this sort of thing. It's just pure sight gags from that point onwards for just a couple of pages of this centurion just turning different colours, you know, in his face as we go along, which is really good. I really like that.
That's a good bit. I like that as well. So.
And another one I wanted to mention was they go to the a theme park. There's a Gaul theme park that's been built, isn't there?
Around the idea of they're going to have this big fight. So this is all the sort of the stuff that goes with it, doesn't it? You know,
yeah.
Like
the hoopla.
The dodging chariots. and they've got shops, haven't they, selling things. They've got W.H. Smicks rather than W.H. Smicks. So this page, which I know you're looking at, is page 38, isn't it?
Yeah.
For anyone reading along at home. And weirdly, when this story was reprinted in Ranger magazine in the 60s,
right.
We'll come on to. And Ranger only lasted 40 issues. And I think there are 44 pages in here. So they've had to squeeze it up a little bit to get it.
Right.
To squeeze it to 44 pages. And one of the pages they entirely missed out in the comic was page 38, which has got a fantastic...
It's a hell of a page, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a hell of a page. It's got a fantastic sort of wooden roller coaster in it. But that page is wholly missed out in Ranger. And so therefore they've got to squeeze 43 pages into 40 weeks. So you think, that's a bit more doable. You know, you lose about one, you know, half a panel a week. You know, we can just about squeeze this in. So it works quite well. And then at one point they're making the Ranger annual for 1967, I think it is.
Okay.
And this single page appears in the annual. Appropriate of absolutely nothing else. They've obviously looked, went back to the filing cabinet and gone, oh, we haven't used that. Oh, but we've paid for it.
Yeah.
Right. I tell you what, you know, squeeze it into the annual. One, it's just, that's it. A single page is in the annual. You know, that's it. There's no story before it. There's no story after it. It's just, no.
That's just bizarre because it actually opens on the story. So while the combatants are in training, the Romans build the ring for the big fight. You know, it's like, it's actually, I suppose it doesn't, really, are they in it? I can't see them being in it. Are they in it?
No, they're not in it. Yeah, so it's okay. They're reason need them to be in it, but it's just, you know, it's like there's not a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. There, that's just one page out of the album which you've just not been able to squeeze into the weekly, and you've gone right. Well, we won't throw it away. We'll definitely use it.
Yeah,
we've got a spare page in the annual. There we go. Slide it in. Nobody will notice. What are you?
Yeah, and it's in the last panel in that page, in a very small sight gag, is the return to a gag that Asterix occasionally used of all books are big slabs of concrete.
They've got to chisel them out of the
yeah, it must take fucking ages quarry. To write someone a note. You know, a message will come from Rome and it'll be on a big slab of concrete and they'll have to carry it about and somebody will break it. And it says, children's comics, 3 bronze coins, the slab. It's pretty cool. Yeah. So we're just over halfway for this. So Vital Statistics is going to fight Cassius Ceramics. And the winner gets to rule the local town, which is quite cool. So it's all a big setup. And it's like a boxing match build up. It's like a wrestling match build up. And they start. But in that time, they're trying to get a fix to sort the potion out, aren't they? That's what he's kind of taking his time.
Because he's still
off his nut. Yeah.
Still off his nut. Too many herbs. and now Psychoanalytics is at it as well. And they're both just laughing at each other. They're both, you know, slurping these different dollops of potion. And it's not really working out, but they keep trying. The fight begins, and you know, you don't know how is Vital Statistics going to win this fight when they still haven't made the magic potion.
He
needs the magic potion.
Yeah, and he turns the tables on us later. But yeah, and one of the things I noticed about this, I didn't realise before, and I think it must be a recurring theme, is Obelix has got his own quarry, and him and Dogmatics go there just to be a bit sad, don't they?
Yeah. That's it. That's his quarry. You know, when he goes to work, you know, he's there. You know, and he's chiseling out minas. I mean, once you've bought one mina, you know, they don't wear out. You know,
even when you throw them on top of people, which happens, I'm gonna say 4 times in this book.
Happens quite a lot in this particular book. Yeah, and so he's, but they're not breaking. You know, they're very
very solid, well made. Wearing, so. Yeah. Yeah, there's a guarantee with those ones. Yeah, and so Vital Statistics is basically running round and round in sort of classic, you know, Ealing comedy style, running round the ring and avoiding Ceramics hitting him. And he realises everything's fine. Getfix is cured. We're fighting fit again. And he says that bit of news redoubles my strength. And he knocks him out of the ring and flying into the air with one punch. I'm the most beautiful. I'm the greatest. I'm the champion. Because he's a bit pompous historically. Is he? Vital Statistics, a bit full of his own. He's like there's a touch of the Captain Mannering about him occasionally, isn't there? Yeah.
It's definitely he's the big fish in the little pond. Of the village, and you know, he likes to. His wife is Impedimenta. She's the only person he's scared of. You know, there's often, you know, she'll be sort of, you know, wagging her finger and pointing at him.
I've got a feeling this was her first appearance. I've got a feeling this book may have been when she appeared first in one of the scenes. I think I read that earlier, but I couldn't pin down which one it was. Yeah. I mean, they're a great. It's a great character built. Town, isn't it? But the two of them. So, for those that have never read an Asterix is always either really happy beating people up, or he's always slightly grouchy because he has to put up with Obelix, who's clearly a buffoon.
They rail quite a lot. I was reading a bit of Asterix and Cleopatra earlier on.
Yeah,
and this whole bit is quite. I think it's quite near the end. You know, so it's not like they're gonna. They're slightly worried that they're gonna lose. You know, but they've gone to see Cleopatra and they're trying to tell her what's going on. Getafix is there as a druid, and he's trying to sort this out. And in the background, you've got Asterix and Obelix are having this row.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a Laurel and Hardy quality to them, isn't there? Where they're absolutely best friends, but they don't get on all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I think as a kid, I think I kind of got them a bit confused in my sort of childlike brain with Popeye and Brutus occasionally. There's that Popeye element to him. You know, Popeye has to eat spinach and Asterix has to have this magic potion to make them strong. And I think it was maybe a little theme of comics and cartoons back in the day where that was a thing. I mean, obviously, he was dealt with like that, Popeye, so that kids would eat their greens. But, you know, maybe there's an element of that to, I suppose he would have seen them when he was in America, Goscinny, you know.
Yeah. Like I say, that's sort of the double act they have them, you know. One is short, one is tall, one is thin, you know, one is fat, you know. They're it's that dichotomy of them, you know. One is clever, one is not clever.
Yeah, the classic. You know,
So,
frustrated and one is just oblivious, and yeah, there's that as well, isn't there? Yeah. So, Vital Statistics wins. He's lifted. He's always on a shield on people's shoulders. That's his kind of mode of travel, isn't he? He gets lifted up and sort of carried about in places when he's in the books. And he's sort of
fantastic bit at the start when they come to challenge him, don't they?
Yeah.
And he's like, right, you know, let's, you know, and then he turns his back on the Romans and the challenger, and then he says, we're off. So then the men that carried him on the shield immediately turn round, which therefore rotates statistics 360 degrees, and he's back to facing the people he started with.
Yeah, he is good. Yeah. And he's a bit of a fat fucker, isn't he, as well? And you can see he's just being lazy. He likes to be carried about a bit, you know, all the time.
Oh, it's when they start going training. Like the first day they go out for a training run, that means the men carrying the shield run while he stands on the shield.
Yeah. And then we get the Romans are not happy, so the Romans decide to attack. They get very quickly beaten. I can't remember. Is it this volume or another one I was reading where for Obelix's birthday they get a load of Romans in for him to fight just because that was his birthday present or something? I think it was one I was reading the other day. And it kind of ends up, we get a bookend of it, ends up with them eating boar again.
Yeah. So that's sort of that classic last panel. You know, they always end up, they're all eating boar, having a, you know, great feast. Cacophonix the Bard has been strung up from a tree.
That's his name. I was just trying to think of him. He's another great character. So he's always fucking annoying, isn't he? Yeah. He's always coming in trying to sing a song or something.
He's got a little harp, hasn't he? A little, he wants to play a tune on, but he's, you know, completely tuneless, and none of them can stand him. So the gag is always, they're always punching him to just shut up. So the last panel always has him not playing the harp, and the rest of them, you know, big fire, you know, plenty of ball being.
That's a lovely
around.
Panel, that last panel as well, with the shadows and the heat. Yeah, really nice. The the last gag is Obelix talks about he wants to eat a little biscuit, and he says, oh, what sort of thing are you going to put on top of it? And he says, I'm going to put a whole boar on top of it. And it reminds me of that joke, the constant Billy Bunter joke, where he'd cut the slice out of the cake and then he'd take the rest of the cake rather than the slice. It's kind of that joke, isn't it? Yeah.
I've cut two slices, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's a great little read, that, man. I've been on and read the Britons. This volume I've got has got Asterix in Britain, The Big Fight, and Asterix and the Normans in it. So to be fair, a really good buy. It's out of Titan, I think, off the top of my head. No, out of Hachette, who's the company that took it on, who bought it from Pilote, I think. And it's $40.99. I think mine was on the sale. It's only $9.99 off Amazon, and it's three volumes, so it's pretty good value. Yeah. For a book, it's a little bit basically printed. The covers are sort of just slammed into the book and stuff like that. But it's a long read. It's a good thing, and it's definitely an all ages thing. Yeah.
Oh yeah, for sure. So yeah, and yeah, like I say, you know, there are so many, you know, gags per panel, you know, per page. You know, for those. I mean, we were talking beforehand. You know, I've been reading a lot of Ken Reed strips. Earlier, and his, you know, if we come across, oh man, we could do an episode on Ken Reed.
Yeah, definitely.
But his strips, you know, again, he's got one page, so you know, you sort of think, oh, he's going to fit, you know, 7, 8, 9 panels in here. You know, he's cramming about 20 panels in, you know, They're very tight, you know, they're fantastically detailed, yeah. You know, and again, you know, it's just, you know, every panel there is something funny happening in them, you know, yeah. And he's so different to a lot of, you know, your classic humour artists on your Wizard and Chips or something where, you know, there is one gag, you know, at the bottom of the page and it takes you a bit of a while to get there.
Yeah. And it's not that funny when you get it.
It's not very funny. Which, you know, if you talk to, you know, Pat Mills about, you know, the sort of people he was working with, you know, when he started at IPC, as it was at
they weren't
the
a laugh
time,
a minute, were they?
The 70s, you know, there are a lot of grumpy, unhappy men writing these humour and inverted strips. And you can think, well, that's why they haven't aged very well, because they weren't very funny to start with. Whereas you get something like this or Ken Reed stuff, you know, and it is still funny, you know.
Yeah.
Ken Reed stuff, you know, it's 50 years old, you know, I was reading it the weekend, I read loads of it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, you know, again, sight gags everywhere. Fantastic. And yeah, that's why, you know, it's lasting.
I think you're right, man. I think you're right. And I suppose the last bastion of that, when you were talking about it there, I was trying to think, well, what else does that? And I suppose the only last bastion of that is Viz. You know, Viz is the last comic that puts sort of 15 panels on a page and they're all stupidly funny, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of the last. I know it's slightly different. I wouldn't recommend it for an all ages, but it's that sort of thing, I think, you know. Is there any sort of particular pages of art that you wanted to pick out that you thought, oh, I really like the way they've done that?
I like the, like I say, those bits where they're, you know, they're changing colour.
I really like that. Yeah.
You know, one page is page 26 on mine.
Right.
Where in panel one is in green, panel two is orange, panel three, yellow.
Yeah.
Dots, stripes. Checkerboard blue, and then the payoff in the next one is that he then becomes rainbow coloured. So, you know, just just reading through all of those, and you know, and it, you know, it's just really funny. And, you know, Getabix is jumping up and down. You know, he's you know, he's having a whale of a time. He doesn't mind. He keeps making these explosions. That he's this poor Roman. He's going all the colours of the rainbow. He's having a lovely afternoon.
Yeah.
He thinks it's hilarious. And Obelix is there, who's fat, and he's just laughing at him. So.
It's that like really drunk friend when he's just pointing at things and laughing, isn't he? I know exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going to say my favourite page is the one we talked about earlier, where Getafix is picking herbs and he comes across the soldiers in the trees. I just can see that. Yeah, I can just see that on my wall at home. I think that would just be amazing. Not that we could ever afford a page from this, I'm sure, but it's gorgeous.
They go for big bucks, don't they? I think they sold of Asterix pages off last week, didn't they, for like for COVID work in France. I mean, from the more recent books.
Yeah.
You know, and they, I don't know, you know, they went for, I don't know, was it 50,000 quid or something? You know,
wow,
and,
okay.
You know, and those are not by Adurzo, they're from the really recent ones, you know.
Yeah.
You know, these ones, I mean, I think probably the Tintin pages, I mean, Heritage Auctions, what they call the really big.
Yeah.
They've sold some Tintin page, haven't they? And they're like, this one is £1.5 million. And this one is.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my, you know, it's like, you know, that is properly up there, you know, with, you know, that with, you know, works of art, you know, level of money that you need to play in this game now. You know, this is not, you know, we'd all love a page of Brian Bond art, and I think, well, I would.
Yeah.
But I can't afford it. But, you know, this is like, wow. I would need to sell a lot of Brian Bolland pages.
Yeah, yeah, you would.
To buy,
you're right, man.
You know,
yeah,
you know, a very small Tintin page. You know?
But the thing about France is it's still. I rabbit on about it, but when I went to Angoulême earlier this year, it's sort of, you were reminded it's not all about cosplayers and stuff like that. It's about you know, collectors and, you know, kids, and everyone's into comics, and there's it's a mainstream thing. So the fact it you know, it's much bid upon. Isn't surprising, really. Yeah, because people. Just
you
want
say
it.
That President Macron turned up.
He did. He did. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God! Can you believe? So, you know, it's just.
I think he went and saw the Wally Wood exhibition. I've got a feeling he went.
Oh my God!
Imagine that! Imagine Boris turning up. You're like, oh really? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty impressive. In fact, I was standing on there. We were just having lunch, and a couple of people I went, "What's that outside?" And it was a demonstration against him being there.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't think he turns up. I don't think someone turns up every year, but he certainly did that year. That was a hell of a mess. Have you done an Angoulême, have you? Or
No. I've never done it. It was really interesting when, to hear you talk about it on the podcast. A, in terms of, you know, it's amazing because you get a Wally Wood exhibition, the president turns up.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's nowhere to stay.
No, there's not. You have to know people. Yeah.
Therefore, if you don't know the publisher, you know, you have to, you know, sleep in the sea or something. So it's like, oh, I'd always thought, oh, I'd love to go to Ormond Gloom. And they were like, oh, it turns out it's not quite
and
as
they're
easy.
And they're much defended. The venues to sleep in. Do you know what I mean? We only Nobrow have had the same, been staying at the same place for like eight, 9 years, and she's like a friend, the lady that runs this house, you know.
Yeah.
And she would have breakfast with us every day, and we saw her in the village and all this sort of thing. And it's once you get that place to stay, it must be like when you stay in the village at Glastonbury or something like that.
Yeah, you got to book it the next year. When you're checking out. Yeah,
yeah. When she dropped us off,
see you next year.
Yeah, when she dropped us off at the train station, she said, "Are you back next year?" And he said, "Oh, definitely. You know, make sure we've got a couple of rooms." You know, it's like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a hell of a place. It's a really lovely town. It's like on a hill. It's like a fort town. You know. You're walking through the town, you're walking past the, you know, the French equivalent of H.H. Smith's and Woolworths or something, and there's announcements coming out saying, oh, such and such will be doing a signing and all this sort of thing in the town. You know, it's like, it's about the size, I'd say, of somewhere like Colchester or something like that. Right. It's that sort of size town. Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
You really take it all over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good man. Right, we're going to have a little chat about what you've been writing about in a minute. I'm just going to pause for an advert, if you don't mind.
No.
Sponsors.
Got to pay the bills.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, man. Feeling a bit down in the dumps, no direction in your life? Then why not spend your days reading a fantastical story, learn all the details, apply some of the life rules this lovely work of fiction has made up, and then shame others because they don't conform to your fictional doctrine? Yes, why not become religious? There you go. That's the new advert.
It's worth thinking about.
I think so.
Public service broadcasting.
It's a life goal for us. So, man, loving your blog. Always see it in the morning. Always give it a little like or a retweet. Over. What's been on the calendar? What's been on the board for the last few weeks? And what's coming up?
I'd say the most interesting thing we've had the last few weeks has been some Shreddy's art from the 1960s.
Another deep dive. Another deep dive.
This is a deep dive into the world of Shreddy's. You know, it's hard to believe I'm trapped in here, but so somebody sent me some scattered Norman Boyd.
We met him at the Mart, didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah, we met him at the Mart. Yeah, you know, a big Frank Bellamy fan, and he just done me some scans of sort of adverts out of Eagle.
Right.
And I thought, oh, that's very kind. Yeah, I could use those sort of, you know, interesting things. And one of them I spotted, it was this sort of advert for a comic from Shreddies.
Right.
Like Shreddies cereal from the early 60s. And I was like, is that a thing? You know, what is that? Can you just Google that? Anyway, turns out you can just Google it. And it led me to this guy's website, which is all about free gifts from the back, you know, from cereal packets. All sorts of brands, you know, over like 100 years is probably too much, you know, because they haven't been giving away cheap plastic tat in
I'm sure.
Shreddies, you know, for that long. But there's a long and proud tradition of giving away tat with breakfast cereal. You know, they've been getting kids to eat that for a long time, and therefore, you know, they've been giving stuff away to encourage you to eat it for a long time. So there was this one particular strip, and I thought, oh, I'll just Google it. Anyway, so I'll Google it, and I ended up on this website. You know, you just end up going down a bit of a rabbit hole with these things. And I was looking around trying to find this advert to say, well, you know, what is this sort of comic? And then started looking at a different set of comics on there that they'd, I guess, I don't know if they were quite, I don't quite know if they were like the back page.
Okay,
Or it looks like they're sort of the back of the box, but in which case the back of the box is just a one-page comic strip, the whole thing.
I wonder, I remember opening a box as a kid and finding stuff inside, printed inside.
You'd have stuff inside, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But this one,
this is
colour artwork.
Yeah.
And it's on more than one, so it's like two pages, weirdly, so I don't know how that works. You'd have to get two boxes of cereal. I don't know. But for the artwork...
When's the next issue out?
Exactly. Mum, can you get different? Not that box. Literally, not that box of cereal. You know, your mum's to come home with the wrong cereal. Oh, it's the wrong cereal. But it's got two pages of this comic strip with this character Shreddy Boy, But it's done by Don Lawrence.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. Is Trigan Empire style.
Fucking
it's like
hell.
2 pages of Trigan Empire, which you've never seen, because it's actually, he's sort of done 2 pages of Trigan Empire. Somebody else has, you know, stuck this Shreddy Boy character all over this beautiful Don Lawrence artwork and said, there we go, there's some advertising. And it's like, wow, where did that come from? Why have I never seen that all my life?
What advertising agency who were probably quite drunk by lunchtime came up with that idea?
Yeah. So then it's like, oh, there's one, it's Don Lawrence, you know, this is amazing. Artist, you know, Trigan Empire people would have come across his beautiful artwork and there.
Yeah.
And you dig a bit more, it's like, oh, hang on, Don Lawrence has done it for 2 pages, but it's part of a series. Oh, well, who else has worked on it? Oh, Ron Embleton's worked on it.
Right.
Oh, my God, you know, Ron Embleton, you know, he does the sort of, I suppose most famously, does the sort of the credit sequence on Stingray.
Yeah.
I think he does all those paintings are by him, and he works on the Thunderbirds comics for years.
Did he do the end bit on Captain Scarlet as well? Did he do the drawings at the end of that as well?
Yes, yeah. On that. Okay. Yeah. A Wicked Wonder, if you, you know, for work people. You know. You know, but, you know, amazing. You know, so he's done 2 pages, and Frank Langford is another very prolific artist. He's done another page. It's like, oh, you know, these strips, you know, completely. Never come across them, never heard anyone talk about them, never seen them. So, yeah, you know, that was really interesting.
Oh, wow.
That
yeah, is, man.
Somebody just, you know, sending me some images and saying, oh, you might like these. You know, it's in, you know, off down a, you know, a rabbit hole to...
Yeah. The research is fun, man, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I'm having a ball.
Yeah.
A ball with this as well, and it's doing stuff like that every day. And you're right, there's not, sometimes it takes a while to find that stuff because there was no internet back then. No one's taking photographs of things, are they, you know?
No. And then it's like, oh, hang on, there's a whole... And then it looks like they've actually produced a comic as well.
Oh, okay.
Which they've then, like, as a promotional item as well for a different series, which is by an artist who I don't recognise and who isn't as good as Lawrence or Embleton or Langford. And certainly there's some of them, I think, hang on, I know exactly what that pose is because you've traced that over a lovely Frank Bellamy page.
Yeah, okay.
Or, you know, it's really like, you know, this is slightly more, the budget isn't quite as much this year, guys. You know, we can't hire those artists. We'll have to get somebody in the office to do it. Right, hang on.
Yeah.
Going to get, you know, going to get the light box out here. and off we go.
Yeah.
So that's been, you know, that's been a fun thing to find out about. Other things, I'm on the, if anyone is, listening to this when it comes out this week.
Yeah.
I've been talking to Ian and Nikki on the late podcast.
Oh, you're on
podcast.
That, you? Okay.
I'm on that this week.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah, so talking about Warhammer comics.
Oh, I've got that downloaded. I haven't listened to that yet. Oh, good stuff. I know Ian loves Warhammer. He's gone nuts for Warhammer. I was chatting to him the other day. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't realise how nuts he was about it, but I had loads of spares. Of what, you know, because I was trying to collect the series. I got one issue I can't find for love nor money. But I'd acquire, you know, loads where you've got to think, I'll buy those three because they're in a run, but I just want the one in the middle.
Yeah, I've just done the same one.
Big box of spares. And I was like, oh, can I quite face going through, you know, listing them one at a time on eBay? This is probably just before we had the lockdown. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure I really can. And then I just saw something they put out. And I was like, oh, hang on, you know, I'll send you some of those. And I was thinking maybe, oh, well, I'll, you know, in those days, you know, the Lags Festival was going to be a real thing in October, and I'm going to that. So I thought maybe I'll just take a few now, and then I'll give him a wad later on. And then we sort of went into lockdown, and I was like, right, hang on. Am I going to see him? Ooh, I don't know. So I thought, I just put them all in a box and said, here you go, you know, knock yourself out. And he was, you know, he was made up to receive them.
They're good people. I like them both. Yeah,
and they are good people, you know. And I love the stuff that they do. You know,
Have you done the lakes before? Have you been up to it before?
No. I was going to be
your first one this year.
My debut year this year.
Yeah.
So got to sort out my Airbnb, see if they'll just let me come the same weekend next year.
Yeah. It's good fun. It's very social. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They took me out. We ended up going around doing a pub crawl, me and them, and it was top life. Yeah. Really good fun. Yeah.
I'd rather we could, you know, even if, you know, the world was a bit in a better place slightly by, you know, October, I think it would, you know, not quite the same in terms of, yeah, you know, you can all go to loads of bars, you can all go to the restaurants, you know, is it going to be like that?
It'd be different when it,
we said to them, you know, that, you know, it might be the week before, they say, yeah, you can all go to bars and restaurants, and you think, oh shit,
yeah,
but you can't organize it, you can't book it all now, so
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you've got to play a bit. So yeah, so I'm really looking forward to going into that.
Yeah, popped up to Thought Bubble as well. So I think still crossing my fingers for Thought Bubble. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens there. Yeah. Good, old man. Thanks for that. We'll do a little outro. So there you have it. That's something you should definitely be reading. If I'm sure most people, it's sold 33 billion copies, asterisk. So I'm sure most people have read it. But if you're maybe some of the younger generations haven't read it, it might be worth having a look for. And it is funny. It properly is funny, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So have a look for that.
Oh, wait, we didn't do the... I was going to tell you that... The crazy comic story.
Yeah.
I got into looking at all sorts of things, that all sorts of Bond Destiny stories that have been reprinted in various magazines.
Okay.
Over the years, so I put up on the blog. You know, people want to really have a real deep dive into particular things.
Yeah.
But I think the favourite one I found was this story. It was in Lion, and the story was called Jinx.
Okay.
INKS, but it was actually from a Belgian magazine, and it had been reprinted in Knockout originally under the title Dicky and Birdbath Watch the Woggle.
Oh, fucking hell. I'll take it they mean the thing that scouts have around their scarves.
No, they actually mean Marsup. I'm going to pronounce his name wrong here. All your French listeners will hate.
Yeah, later.
Marsupilami. He's this sort of crazy. He's on that page 38.
All right, okay.
Which is the scene at the sort of the fun fair,
yeah,
just outside WH Smicks. The next tent Tim is this thing. It's called Menagerie.
Oh yeah, see, I saw that. Fabulous. Yeah, yeah.
So it's crazy. I think he's supposed to be a leopard, but he's got his huge, enormous, long.
Oh, I know who you mean exactly. Yeah, I've seen that character before. Yeah,
yeah. So the woggle in this case was Marsupilami. But yeah, this idea, you could have a story called Dickie and Birdbath Watch the Woggle. I mean, Dickie. You wouldn't get that printed these days. That's all I'm saying.
Dickie and Birdbath. Now I've got some special names to call Vince and Dan. Vicky and... Yeah, lovely. Brilliant. Dickie and Birdbath. Yeah, brilliant stuff.
Leave that with you.
Yeah. A little present. There you go. Thanks, man. So you can find me at neveronanything.blogspot.com. You can follow me on Twitter, S-O-S-E-Z-O-H-Y-Z. So where can people find the blog, and where else can we find you on the socials, Rich?
On the socials, so I'm at Richard and Sheaf, S-H-E-A-F. And you can follow my blog at boysadventurecomics.blogspot.co.uk. Post up something every day there on some element of British comics.
Are you gonna pull back on that? Did you put a time limit on that at one point, or so I'm just gonna do it forever?
Yeah, I was gonna keep trying to do it forever. Really, I probably mentioned last time. You know, it gets a little bit harder each day. Well, I've done that, but then you know, you end up going down this shreddy rabbit hole, and you think, oh, suddenly I've got enough for like 10 posts that I've just whistled up from nowhere. You know, that's been a good evening's, you know, fun doing that. And I'll put my notes from the show up on the blog.
Oh, brilliant.
There are, you know,
yeah, that'd be really useful.
People really want to look at it. You know, there are all sorts of things from Knockout, from Valiant, some of the stuff around, you know, because I guess when, I mean, I picked this title because it was the first asterisk story that was printed in this country.
Okay, right.
I think in its entirety, but it had been they've been in other stories as well.
Yeah,
they'd been really hacked about, like in Valiant. It was in Valiant for about 6 months, but they got through I think a couple of books,
right?
And they all had different names. It was like Little Fred is what they called Asterix.
Oh really? Okay.
Yeah. And Obelix is Big Ed. Little Fred is Big Ed. That's right. Get a Fix is called Hocus Pocus.
Right, I can see that. Yeah.
So it's only you know, we think we know their names, but that's because we're reading the volumes that have been translated and sold in the 70s, and they've got that translation, and we just go with that. But in other issues beforehand, they all had different names. Like in the Ranger version, where this story came from, Asterix is called Beric.
Oh, Beric, really?
The Bold. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Dogmatics is just, he's Fido.
Right.
Because I guess actually, when think about it, actually in Valiant, it's actually, although it's not set in France, it's set in England.
Oh, wow.
Asterix,
okay.
English.
God, don't tell the French that. Bloody hell.
The ancient Brit with bags of grit. is how it was sort of set up. So yeah, so it's all very strange. You know, you go back and look at some of these other ones and go, oh, hang on, what you know, what's going on here? It's like, well, it looks a lot like Asterix, but actually, you know, it's all quite different. And there's some of them are a lot wordier. Yeah, but I guess because in a comic you're thinking you can't be sort of skipping through it. You're like, no, I've got to get you to look at this page.
Yeah, so actually, the good old British comics way. Yeah, as it was.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting, man. I didn't know that. I'd quite like to see that actually. Yeah, that's cool. And you've got have you got links to that on your blog that you'll include in the notes, or have you written stuff on that? Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I'll do all that.
So. If anyone, if you are just looking at the show notes on your phone, having downloaded this episode, I'll put the blog address in the notes, so when you click on the podcast episode, you'll be able to click through to the site as well. So I'll do that as well, just in case. Yeah, that's great. Brilliant stuff, man. Right, good. Right. We'll do a fake goodbye now, and we'll chat about when you're going to come back on now next after I stop recording. Cheers, Rich.
Cheers, Tony. Bye.